From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia, at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. Once again here on the show, we'll visit with a new series that we've been airing since June of this year, Exploring Ethnobiology. Through a scientific lens, ethnobiology examines the relationships between humans and their surrounding plants, animals, and ecosystems. And so with seemingly more and more peoples becoming interested in developing closer relationships with our surroundings, our food, the earth, there's much we can all learn from ethnobiologists, and in particular from the symbiotic human-earth relationships that so many peoples around the world have long maintained. Food sovereignty is also a subject that permeates much of what we air here on the show, and similarly permeates much dialogue among ethnobiologists. At the 2010 International Congress of Ethnobiology held in Tofino, BC, a group of ethnobiologists gathered to discuss food sovereignty, and in particular the immaterial or intangible components of food sovereignty. We'll listen in on some of that discussion today in the first half of the show, and in the second half, we listen to Associate Professor at Cornell University's Department of Horticulture, Jane Mount Pleasant, whose research has involved a fascinating comparative look into 17th and 18th century cereal grain farming among the Iroquois people of what is now upstate New York and early European colonizers. Her research paints a telling picture of just how much of our Western food system is built upon a propensity to maintain the status quo, instead of adapting to our surroundings and working in closer relationship with the land on which we grow our food. While food sovereignty is a theme underlying much of what is discussed here on Deconstructing Dinner, it's been a while since we've specifically examined just what food sovereignty is. The Nyalani Declaration has become the most referred to explanation of what food sovereignty should mean. It was defined in 2007 at the Nyalani Forum for Food Sovereignty in Silingue, Mali, and named after a legendary Malian peasant woman who farmed and fed her people well. Gathering at the forum were peasant farmers, herders, fish workers, indigenous peoples, migrant workers, women, and young people. The forum recognized the participants' heritage as food producers as being critical to the future of humanity, and especially so in the case of women and indigenous peoples who are historical creators of knowledge about food and agriculture and are undervalued. The forum further recognized that this heritage and all of our capacities to produce healthy, good, and abundant food are being threatened and undermined by neoliberalism and global capitalism. With the principles of food sovereignty guiding our relationship to food and food policies, it's believed that we can find the power to preserve, recover, and build on our food-producing knowledge and capacity. Food sovereignty is the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods. It defends the interests and inclusion of the next generation. It offers a strategy to resist and dismantle the current corporate trade and food regime and directions for food, farming, pastoral, and fishery systems determined by local producers and users. Food sovereignty promotes transparent trade that guarantees fair incomes to all peoples, as well as the rights of consumers to control their food and nutrition. It ensures that the rights to use and manage lands, territories, waters, seeds, livestock, and biodiversity are in the hands of those of us who produce food. The full Nyalani Declaration is linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website, but it was the principles of food sovereignty that formed the foundation for a fascinating session held in May 2010 among ethnobiologists at the International Congress of Ethnobiology held this year in Tofino, British Columbia. While food sovereignty can often be defined quite tangibly through food, farming, hunting and gathering, systems of trade as examples, what can easily be overlooked are the intangible principles of food sovereignty. In other words, the ways in which maintaining food sovereignty contributes to the social, cultural, and spiritual well-being of peoples around the world. By looking at food sovereignty through this lens, the importance of all people's interests to maintain and create the food systems that we all want to see is elevated substantially. There were about 25 to 30 people participating in the session, and we'll have time to hear four of those participants. The first, Justin Nolan, an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Justin specializes in ethnobotany and the foodways among the Cherokee and Ozark peoples, and he shared the outcomes of his own research when he discovered that food sovereignty is intimately connected to language. the language of food, and the preservation of language itself.
I'd like to share today with you guys a sort of an embarrassing story, which is the result of having used conventional anthropology in a food ways study in Cherokee Nation recently. But it was embarrassing in a good way, because I realized that through humility and recognition of one's failures in the field, that exciting and rewarding new discoveries, I think, can be found. I had been asked about 2 years ago to work with the Cherokees in a way that would help them revive or maybe re-perpetuate their language. Right now in Oklahoma, there are maybe 900 speakers left of the language, and the number's dwindling. And I was charged with the task of finding out what keeps the families or what keeps the language alive. And so little did I know that by looking at this question and examining who speaks the language and using conventional field techniques, that I would be led into the study of food ways. But the two are connected, and I'll sort of conclude with that, and I won't take up too much time. But the main thing I wanted to explain was that after about a year of having used conventional surveys and spending time with the elders and their community and participant observation and asking questions related to language use and context, it became very apparent that families who were raised in proximity to their maternal grandmothers were about 12 times more likely to acquire and speak the language than not. So it turns out that there's a strong matrilineal social force that's at work in maintaining the integrity of the language. But in so doing, I was led inevitably into the realm of cooking and food. And so I began to understand and wonder, well, because it's a matrilineal society, to what extent can more be learned about language and food ways if I spoke with the grandmother? So the grandmothers finally let me into their community center and asked me to show them the results, that they could look it over and scrutinize all of the charts and the sort of fancy ethnoscientific graphs and so forth. And after long pauses and these glances of discontentment, I figured I really need to know how I can improve this, or what to do, or how can I make it right. And so they said, get some poster board. Roll out a big piece of paper. We want to really show you the way that foods are understood and used and classified and so forth. And so they drew a big wheel and started with the month of January. And then they progressed and proceeded through the cycle of the year. Mm-hmm. And they said, although you've almost shown seasonality, you've failed to show how knowing the words for foods links directly into their location, into their habitat, and into their use, and so forth. And so, although this had begun to reveal itself, it was not clear at all until I realized that by learning the names for things like fire on the water, which is watercress in February, which they placed sort of on the northeast side of the quadrant, and they said, well, in the northeast, when you look for watercress, you're looking for fire on water. It's a green plant that's sort of herbaceous, but it's a little bit like seaweed that grows on top of clear moving streams. Well, one of them said, well, fire on water, it's green flames that grow, you can see it sparkling on the stream. And immediately another one said, well, that's not exactly true. She said, it's really more spice on the stream. And so I thought, fire on the water, green fire on the water, spice on the stream. Well, then they both laughed and said, well, both are true. And there was something sort of sublime and revealing in the fact that in the names for things, they become known, but then they become known because they are named. And it seems to me very relevant now that by understanding and taking a subtle approach to language analysis that and by using unconventional methods and sometimes by throwing away what seemed to be safe conventional anthropological techniques and just abandoning yourself to the forces around you, you learn things in strange and fascinating ways. So we were able to complete a fairly comprehensive and exhaustive list of the types of foods that were found. For example, in January, you gather hickory nuts to make kanuchi, which is later on delivered to neighbors as a sign of communion and commitment in February. And in February, you begin to look for other things like possum grapes and watercress. And then March and then April roll around, and you begin to look for other things like huckleberries and And at that time, you'll look for morels and mushrooms and all the 8 to 10 different types of mushrooms that are edible. But it was never really apparent to me, for example, that wild rose, the rabbit eats it, or that learning the word for fern, you know, the deer and the bear lay upon it, that you begin to develop more comprehensive and sort of metaphoric understandings of foods and their role in sustaining Cherokee social life. So later on, at the end of our project, we had a big communal feast, and everyone in the community came out, and I realized that it's not just through talking about food and participating in gathering, but ultimately the preparation and the sharing of it, that social life is rendered especially meaningful. So I was especially, I think, rewarded to have learned the art of humility in the field, and the art of, or not the art of, or at least just the, you know, the embracing of what seemed to be on the spot alternative methods or unconventional methods. But in a way, I think that may be more a testimony to my own my own sort of ignorance and so forth. But learning how ignorant you are for me at least has become sort of a passageway into perhaps new and more rewarding avenues of inquiry. But there's no doubt that through food and through language, at least, the new understandings of the cultural life and the texture and the fabric of social life and how it's woven together through social events such as foodways and food sharing.
Justin Nolan of the University of Arkansas, also sharing perspectives on the intangible components of food sovereignty as part of the session, was Canadian Nancy Turner of the University of Victoria, who we've heard from on a few occasions now as part of this Exploring Ethnobiology series here on Deconstructing Dinner. Nancy Turner uses the example of the sword fern in helping describe the important relationships between plants, food, and culture.
As I walked over here, I started thinking about food sovereignty and what it means. And having worked, I should probably introduce myself maybe. I have worked in British Columbia and learned from elders and knowledge holders for over 40 years in different parts of British Columbia, but including here in Pequot Sound. And what I've learned is pretty hard to describe, but it shows just the deep and rich and complex connections that people have with their home places, and the knowledge that goes so deep, it's not divided up into little bits and pieces, but it's interconnected in so many ways. And I thought I would just maybe share a little bit of that with you. This plant is, I picked the oldest leaf because it's going to be dying back. But you probably recognize it as that big clumping fern that is used quite a bit as landscaping around here. This is the sword fern. And one of the elders I've worked with a lot was John Thomas of the Didydat Nation. And he told me about this fern. They call it Palapalamut in the Didydat language. And Pala means one. And he told me one of the contests that especially young men would play in his childhood, and he's passed away now, but it was every boy was given one of these sword ferns, and they had to take each leaflet and pull it off one at a time, saying Pala with each in one breath to see how many they could take off in one breath. So Pala, 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 and so forth. All in one breath. And the one who could do the most was the winner of the contest. But there was more to it than just the contest, because it was very important for young men to be able to hold their breaths for a long time, because they were the divers. And they went to special places along the coast where there were beds where the kelp was very long. And they had to dive down to cut the bottom of the kelp stipe. And that was their fishing lines, among other things. And so they needed nice, long, strong ones. And there were special places. It wasn't just any kelp, any place, but special places where they went to get the very best ones. And so they had to hold their breath for 2 or 3 minutes while they're diving down like that. So then they took those kelp lines and they had to cure them. And it took sometimes a year, John said, to cure the kelp. They had to soak it in fresh water and stretch it and twist it, dry it out, rub it with oil. Pretty soon it was totally impregnated with oil. And then when you use them, you have to soak them. And you can tie them together using a fisherman's knot. And the other part of this story, it goes on and on. But if you go to the forest, you get the tree knots from rotten logs. They're like daggers. And those are the wood that's very, very strong and tough, because if you think of the tree branches being leveraged by the wind all the time, they're the last bit of solid wood that's left when a log is rotting. And you take those, you get one about this long from a hemlock, and you cut it, you split it lengthwise into 3 or 4 pieces, and you shape each one, rounded on the top and flat on the bottom. Then you take the bulb of a kelp plant and you put a bit of water in the bottom and you put those long pieces in there and you plug them up with wood or moss and you bury it in the hot sand under a fire overnight. And in the morning they're just flexible. And then you bend them according to a form to make the hooks that are used for catching cod and halibut. So the kelp has all of that importance to it as a fishing and in creating the fishing gear. And the same young men who are trained to dive for the kelp are the same young men who are trained to dive down and tie the whale's mouth shut when they caught the whale. And you know the whale was killed with a long harpoon made of pieces of yew wood that are very carefully fit together. And they also use a really complex harpoon head that's made with a giant mussel shell and with tree pitch from the forest, the spruce pitch. So all of these elements that seem to be disconnected in our food systems are really all tied together, like Hishu Ishtsawa. You can't separate the forest food from the ocean food. You can't separate the food from the materials that are used to harvest and to process the food. It's all kind of interconnected in amazing ways that we never normally think about. And that's just one small example of a small little bit of a much, much larger system of knowledge around food in this place. And if we think about this place, and then think about the food systems in other communities up and down the coast, and other communities in the interior, other communities across North America, across the Americas, and all the other continents. The complexity and the richness of that is just overwhelming. And yet there's these forces in the world that are the kind of the industrialization, commercialization, homogenization that's trying to, I guess, just eliminate all of that complexity and try and feed all of us, you know, cardboard in a bun. I'm getting carried away. I think I better stop now. But
Nancy Turner, speaking as part of a session titled The Immaterial Components of Food Sovereignty, held as part of the May 2010 International Congress of Ethnobiology, hosted in Tofino, British Columbia. If you miss any of the show today, it is archived at deconstructingdinner.ca and the October 28th, 2010 broadcast. A couple more voices to listen in on who shared their perspectives as part of that session, including Lewis Williams of the Saot First Nation, one of 5 bands that make up the Saanich Nation and located north of Victoria, BC, near the community of Saanichton. Lewis Williams is involved in Feasting for Change, a project that looks to preserve traditional indigenous foodways on Vancouver Island. Lewis spoke of some of the threats of food harvesting practices among indigenous peoples and used the example of the reef nets, once used by indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest to harvest salmon.
The ReefNet technology is our technology that we use to harvest our salmon, and it's a really excellent way to harvest the salmon, because you can selectively harvest what you're going to be actually taking, and the way the ReefNet is set up is actually for the salmon into thinking that they're going into an eelgrass bed. And it's a really massive net, and the willow bark fibers is used to construct the reef net, and then the dune grass is used to for the salmon when you lay your trap in like a cove. And it's so massive that you can actually go in and just selectively harvest the ones that you want. And it's a sustainable method, because there's actually it's not an enclosed trap. There's a hole actually at the end of that trap, so that the salmon can go and continue the next generations. And the reason that I was told that was put there is that if you're smart enough to find that hole, you're smart enough to live. And the reason why it was so sustainable in its ability to selectively harvest is that it actually gave us the opportunity to sit in the canoe and pick out the salmon that we were going to harvest, and then the ones that we didn't need to harvest, we just let go again. Because with each school of salmon, they're all individual families, and you never want to wipe out a whole family. Mm-hmm. You want that family to keep coming back to you.
Lewis Williams also described how that practice was intentionally destroyed by Europeans, yet today is now used by European descendants.
It was actually outlawed in, I don't know when, it was outlawed because of the European fish fisheries. Hunitum is Saanich's word for Europeans. And if you translate Hunitum into English, it translates to the people who appeared, because they just showed up on our beach one day. And, yeah. But it was outlawed by their fisheries, because they thought we had an unfair advantage over the modern fishing fishermen. And look at what's going on now. Just a lot of devastation within a lot of the fish stocks, especially the salmon stocks, for various reasons. But now, actually, there's a group just down in Washington that is using our technology as a environmentally sustainable way of harvesting salmon. And if you take all their technology that they're using now and overlay on our technology, it is ours. They're borrowing it. I'll be polite and I'll say they're borrowing it. And the only difference in those two technologies is the materials. They're using synthetic materials, whereas we used organic materials.
Lewis Williams, speaking of the reef nets once used by indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest. And the last voice we'll hear from the session on the immaterial components of food sovereignty is that of Linda Differencloud. Linda is an ethnobotanist and restoration ecologist of the Standing Rock Lakota Nation in what is now North and South Dakota. Linda also teaches at Sitting Bull College, and she shared another unique perspective on food sovereignty by suggesting that food sovereignty does not necessarily equal local food, but can also equal the cultural and social connections that all people share through the trading of food.
Hey, I'm Linda Differencloud, and I'm from the Standing Rock Lakota Nation. And I just wanted to talk about something that I think could potentially be really interesting. And it's just sort of in the discussion phase right now. But so I guess the story behind this is that I was talking to an elder one day, and we were pit roasting bison. We were pit roasting a buffalo. And, we put certain plants in there and things with it. And she said, this just always tastes so much better when we pit roast it with seaweed. And I was like, I looked at her, I was like, I said, do you mean like the algae from the river? And she was like, no, stupid. I mean seaweed, you know. She was kind of frustrated that I had questioned her, right? And she was like, I mean seaweed. And I'm from the Dakotas, right? So like the most landlocked place. I had to, of course, ask her about it. And I said, well, where would we have gotten seaweed? And she said, well, think about all of the things that we eat that are traditional foods that even I know of that we don't actually produce or harvest. Huckleberries, corn, which we, you know, would steal from the Mandan, but hey. And she named off this list of like 5 or 6 different things, which sort of almost a palm that grows in the southern United States. And she was like, we as indigenous people have these extensive trade networks, mm-hmm. right, that supplemented our diet in really healthy and fun ways that also, I think, promoted peace, right? We had the talk about peace and sustainability the other day. And I think it helped us to appreciate each other as people. And so I think it would, I want to go to Terra Madre in Italy again this year. And really, because when I was there, there were people sort of selling their wares. And there were people from 3 different continents selling nettles, you know, and for the same purpose. And I just think that, you know, it would be so interesting if we could renew these sort of trade networks, and it would also promote sustainability within our tribes and within our groups and outside of that also, and give us a new sort of appreciation. And like the things I'm hearing, you know, we're talking about food sovereignty. I can't imagine anything more sovereign than building these networks back up and even extending them now that we have access to people all over the world. There's so much focus on eating locally, which I think is fantastic and important. But I think there are also really sustainable ways to appreciate the food that other people have. And so I would like you all to, I invite you all to have this discussion with each other and with me, hopefully, at some point about how we can renew these trade networks. And because I would love to be pit roasting bison with seaweed again. You know what I mean? So that's just a thought.
Linda Different Cloud of the Standing Rock Lakota Nation. Again, all those voices heard in the first half of the show today were recorded as part of a session titled The Immaterial Components of Food Sovereignty, held as part of the 12th Annual International Congress of Ethnobiology in Tofino, British Columbia. The session hosted perspectives on how the principles of food sovereignty, that is, the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, goes beyond just the tangible outcomes of food and enters into the intangible realm of the cultural, social, and spiritual relationships that all people can maintain through their food. If you missed any of this first half of the show today, it is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca and the October 28th, 2010 broadcast. This is Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia, at Kootenai Co-op Radio CJLY. I'm John Steinman. Today marks part 4 in our ongoing series Exploring Ethnobiology, which features recordings from my visits to 2 international gatherings of ethnobiologists held back in May of this year in Victoria and Tofino, BC. The field of ethnobiology brings together people from many disciplines, anthropology, ecology, botany, archaeology, to name just a few, who are in some way examining the relationships between peoples, plants, animals, and ecosystems. It's a field that helps bridge the sometimes difficult to describe interconnectedness of people's foodways and culture by looking at those relationships through a scientific lens. In what was one of the more tangible examples of this, shared as part of those 2 conferences, Associate Professor Jane Mount Pleasant of Cornell University's Department of Horticulture shared some fascinating research on indigenous cropping systems in what is now upstate New York. In the 17th and 18th centuries, Iroquois farmers produced 3 to 5 times more grain per unit of land than their European counterparts. Her research is suggestive that the root of the many agricultural woes that plague North American farmers today might very well have been due to our inability then and now to adapt to our new surroundings. Instead of adapting, it appears that Europeans looked to maintain the same cultivation practices of the same foods, while on that same land, Iroquois farmers were producing more food per acre, using different foods and different practices. As Jane Mount Pleasant described, while many scholars assume that the plow played a major role in advancing agriculture in Europe, the Iroquois have demonstrated that more stable agricultural systems can be achieved by not plowing. Here's Jane Mount Pleasant speaking in May 2010 at the annual gathering of the Society of Ethnobiology, held in Victoria, BC.
I have a great deal of interest in Iroquois agriculture, particularly in maize. And after having done quite a bit of both field research and other types of investigations, I got very curious about how Iroquois agricultural production, particularly maize as a cereal grain, might have compared with European grain production at the same time. So I began looking at what wheat yields or cereal grain yields of barley, wheat, rye, oats looked like in the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe. And as you can see from this graph, yields were generally pretty low. In much of Europe, they struggled even up until the end of the 18th century to get above 10 to 15 bushels per acre of grain. And it was only in the temperate North Sea and also South and Western Europe that they were able to get yields that, you know, approached 20 to 25 bushels per acre. Much of this data comes from Slitcher Van Bath, who's an agricultural historian. He took this yield data from all sorts of records, beginning probably from about 600 AD on, manor records, monastery records, tax records. And so these are kind of multiple types of data that were collected over long periods of time. Also, I have some particularly wheat yields in England, Germany, France, and the Netherlands, again from 1600s through 1800. And you see once again this very low yields that farmers were getting at this time, with the exception of the Netherlands. And at that time in the 1750s to 1800s, there were several records of very substantial yields in this area, primarily because they were using compost and night soil and animal waste in an intensive, you know, management scheme. Well, now switching from European cereal, grain cereal production, to North American, your first question might be, well, what's the basis of that comparison? And it turns out that actually the cereal grains in both places are produced in quite similar environments in terms of climate and also in terms of soils. Iroquois in the northeast New York are glaciated soils, tend to be alfasols and inceptisols. In Europe, they tend to be alfasols, inceptisols, and mollisols. But very similar in terms of climatic conditions. Also, both the crops, maize in North America and wheat in Europe, are cereal grains. They're, you know, grasses, and relatively similar in terms of food value. So I've been very interested for a long time in how we might get a handle on grain yields, maize yields, in Iroquois. And some of our best evidence comes from documents by European observers. And I have just two examples here. The first is de Nonville, who was a Frenchman in Montreal. In 1687, he came down into Iroquois around present-day Rochester, New York. And he was on a mission to wipe out as many Iroquois, and particularly Seneca, villages as he could, and to destroy their agriculture, because the Seneca and the Onondagas, both Iroquois nations, part of the Confederacy, were allied with Great Britain at that time, and they were supporting Great Britain with corn, with maize. And of course, France and Great Britain were in a contest for who was going to control North America. De Nandl came down in a period of about 9 days. He reported that he destroyed more than 1.1 million bushel of corn grain. This was both stored grain and grain that was standing in the field. He was there in about July. And he quoted at one point, he said, "The quantity of corn which we found in store in this place and destroyed by fire is incredible." So he was clearly impressed at the quantity and the extent of agriculture in the 1600s. 100 years later, during the Sullivan campaign, this was the Revolutionary War, John Sullivan, ordered by George Washington, also came up into the center of Iroquois, once again on a mission to destroy Seneca, Cayuga, and Onondaga cornfields, because once again the Iroquois were allied with their allies Great Britain and were supplying Great Britain's soldiers with corn. We have the records of literally hundreds of soldiers who came into Iroquois in the 1787, and they recorded in their diaries and journals what they saw. And these are simply three quotes, all taken at the end of August in 1787, that described the type of agriculture that was there. And they're remarkably similar in terms of what they say. "Large expanses, 150 acres of the best corn I ever saw. In such quantities would be almost incredible to a civilized people. Some corn stalks measured 18 feet and a cob 1 foot and a half long." So we have lots of descriptions of this agriculture that makes it sound as though it's very high yielding. Well, as an agricultural scientist, I wanted to see if we could reproduce those conditions in the field and get a quantitative measures of what the corn might have yielded. So we did experiments 2 years in Tompkins County. This is in the southern tier of New York State, and then 2 years in Cayuga County, which is located more in the center part of New York, in our agriculturally rich soils. So Tompkins County, not so great soils. They tend to be acid and relatively infertile, shorter growing season, whereas Tompkins County or Cayuga County is our most intensive agricultural area. So what you see is we're looking at bushels per acre of grain in 93 and 94. We had a couple of different spacings, 30, 40, and 48 inches in 93-94, 40, 48, and 60 inches in 96 and 97. And you see in the Tompkins County, we're basically running from 20 to 40 bushels per acre of maize. In Cayuga County, we're running between 40 and 75 bushels of maize. So when I began thinking about these numbers in my head and then doing some comparisons, I was shocked. Because all of a sudden, I'm thinking European agriculture, wheat, and they're getting 7, 14, maybe 28 bushels per acre of grain. And Iroquois farmers at the same time period are getting 30, 50, and 70 bushels per acre of maize. So then I thought a little bit more about it in terms of the carrying capacity. As I mentioned before, wheat and maize are quite similar in the numbers of calories that they provide per unit, per kilogram of grain. So it's pretty easy to calculate out how many people you can support on an acre of maize. If you have a low yield, you might get you could support 3.5 people for a year with a maize with that yield of maize. To as high as 8 at our very highest yields, that would be 75 bushels per acre. At the same time, the European farmers were struggling, even at their highest yield levels, to support even 3 people per acre of wheat. So now the question is, what in the world is going on here? Why are the Iroquoian farmers so much more productive than their European counterparts. It is, I think, probably counterintuitive to the messages and certainly my understanding of agriculture in Europe versus agriculture in the Western Hemisphere. I've used my experience and my knowledge of agriculture, crop management, and I've come up with an explanation for this. And it has to do first with plows and soil organic matter, the interaction between these, and second, the differences in these two crops, maize and wheat. So let me explain as quickly as I can what I think is going on here. The first is what I call the paradox of plows. Agricultural historians have been telling us for a very long time that the adoption of the plow is the mark of civilization, and it leads to increased agricultural productivity, increased human populations, more complex social organizations, and the rise of cities. Hirt, one of our American agricultural historians, has said, through the ages, the plow has been the most important agricultural tool. Indeed, without it, farmers could not till the soil and prepare their fields for extensive agriculture. What is most amazing about this quote is that Hirt, is most known for his work as a historian of Indian agriculture in the Western Hemisphere. And one wonders, how could he have written this sentence and been studying indigenous agriculture in the Western Hemisphere? Where does this meet and make any sense at all? Plowing has enormous advantages, and farmers the world round have often succumbed to its many things that it offers. Primarily, a seedbed that facilitates germination. It can increase plant available nutrients. It's a way of removing weeds that are already there. It's a way to incorporate animal manures, fertilizers, and lime, and it also can increase rooting depth. In particular, for European farmers, in this time that I'm talking about, plowing was absolutely critical because it created this optimal seedbed for the germination of wheat and other small grains. Wheat seeds, because of their size, germinate most readily if they're in direct and firm contact with moist soils. The wheat seeds are very vulnerable to moisture stress, and so even if the seed germinates, unless there's sufficient moisture in the soil and the seed has good contact with that soil, the seedling dies if the young roots can't penetrate the soil to access more water. The wheat seedlings are also very vulnerable to competition from existing weeds. So plowing for wheat makes a lot of sense. It also was incredibly important because plowing initially increases soil fertility, and it does this because oxidation of soil organic matter occurs when the soil is disturbed and exposed to the air. When you oxidize soil organic matter, you release nitrogen, which is usually the most limiting nutrient for cereal grains. And so when you plow and you oxidize soil organic matter, you get a nice boost in grain yields. So plowing fields that have been fallowed or pastured and allowed to accumulate soil organic matter is a very reliable mechanism for providing nitrogen to crops. All right, so all of these advantages, what are the drawbacks? They're primarily related to two things. When you plow and you oxidize that soil organic matter, it's a great trick the first year and maybe even the second, third, and fourth years. But if you do it continuously, the oxidation continues, and every year less nitrogen is released because the soil organic matter levels burn up. And pretty soon, you get down to what we call a very stable soil organic matter level, about 2%. The amount of nitrogen that's released when soils have 2% is very small, and it remains at that level indefinitely. Farmers call soils with this amount of soil organic matter level worn out. They're no longer able to release nitrogen. We know that plowing is the single largest cause of decreased soil organic matter in agricultural fields. The second thing that happens when you plow fields is that you increase soil erosion. The combination of these two things makes plowing soils one of the most destructive activities that farmers can engage in. All right, so let's go back and look again at maize in Iroquois. Some of the characteristics are this. First, it's an agriculture that's done without plows. Hand tools, there's no animals. Now, most agricultural historians have looked at Iroquoian agriculture, at Western hemispheric agriculture, as deficient or at a disadvantage because of the lack of plows and domesticated animals. I would argue otherwise. In addition to the fact that the crops were planted and managed without tillage and without animals, the maize was often frequently intercropped with beans and squash. And again, in kind of contradiction to kind of common understanding, these fields were most likely planted continuously. This was not shifting cultivation. The intensive maize production in Iroquois takes place in this band that's outlined by red there. It's the center part of the state. These are high lime soils, relatively flat, quite fertile, and in an environment, a climate with sufficient moisture and temperature for good corn yields. The soils where these are taking place are predominantly alfasols. They have high soil organic matter levels, about 4% before they were plowed and cultivated by Euro-American farmers at the end of the Revolutionary War. If we calculate out what they might contribute to in terms of releasing nitrogen, about 90 pounds per acre per year, that when it's combined with other nitrogen sources is sufficient to produce 50 to 75 bushels per acre of maize. As I mentioned, these are high pH soils with moderate base status and making them very favorable for maize growth. What I would argue then, as long as these soils were not plowed and maize yields were moderate, somewhere between 50 to 75 bushels per acre, these yields could be maintained indefinitely without depleting soil organic matter. And in fact, the Iroquois then had these very high stable yields because they didn't plow. This was not something that they were operating under a deficit and managing to accommodate the lack of plows, but one of the main reasons for their high productivity was the fact that they didn't plow. The second thing has to do with characteristics of the plants themselves, maize versus wheat. First, it has to do with seed size. Maize is quite a large seeded cereal grain, whereas wheat is much smaller. That means that maize is ideally suited for growing in a rough seed bed, which is what a no-till system is. In contrast, wheat needs that very finely prepared seed bed. Maize is much larger, it's tall, it's very hardy, it's fast-growing, it competes aggressively against weeds, and it's resistant to a wide variety of pests. Again, in contrast to wheat, which is much slower growing and more and smaller in stature, much more vulnerable. Surprisingly, this is often overlooked, a kernel of maize produces somewhere between 200 to 600 kernels in the field. If you look at wheat, typically a wheat kernel produces less than 100 kernels and oftentimes less than 10. The other thing, this then affects the seeding rate. Seeding rates of maize, 18 to 15 pounds per acre, wheat, 60 to 180. If we look at seed yield ratios, this is often what were calculated in Europe. You're looking at the amount of yield divided by the amount that was planted. If you harvested 20 bushels per acre of wheat and you used 2 bushels per acre to plant, you have a YSR of 10. You look at that same 20 bushels per acre of maize. If you use 15 pounds per acre to plant, you have a YSR of 75. If we look at the seeding rates and yields of wheat and maize, you see that maize, the yield seed ratios at 70 bushels per acre are over 300. Wheat never gets, at even at 70 bushels per acre, the yield seed ratio is under 50. If you look at the portion of your harvest that you have to save for wheat as opposed to maize, 20% at the lower yield levels of, say, 15 bushels per acre to less than 3% for maize. So all of these things give incredible advantages to maize over wheat. Iroquois farmers, 3 to 5 times as much on the same area of land. This higher productivity is attributed to the maintenance of soil organic matter levels, also to the fact that the maize itself is ideally suited for these conditions, has a higher yield potential, and a much lower portion of the maize yield has to be saved in order to plant next year's crop.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was Jane Mount Pleasant speaking in May 2010 at the annual gathering of the Society of Ethnobiology held in Victoria, British Columbia. Links to more information on the topics covered today, including links to past episodes of our Exploring Ethnobiology series, can be found online at deconstructingdinner.ca. And in closing out this part 4 of the series, here's a short clip of well-known Canadian ethnoecologist Nancy Turner.
Well, I'll just say, because I happen to remember that as we did that beautiful walk through the forest, mm-hmm. I looked down at a timat plant and the beautiful yellow flower, and there was the little beetle that was crawling up the they call it the club, mm-hmm. the flower.
Spadix.
Thank you. And it reminded me very much that this little beetle that pollinates the tea mat is specific to that plant, and the tea mat needs it, and it needs the tea mat. And it's just a reflection of these amazing connections. We can't just think about any one particular food without thinking of the entire system, the pollinators that allow the food to reproduce, and just about any food system you think about, there's those kinds of connections.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. A thanks to my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show was provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.